In 2017, when a trans woman disappears from the village, alarm bells go off.
Girls go missing, girls end up dead.
So her friends decide enough is enough.
Justice for Laura!
This is the story of what happens when sex workers and trans people stand up to fight the system that failed them. I'm Justin Ling, and this is The Village, Season 2. Available now on the CBC Listen app and everywhere you get your podcasts.
Every day, more people are saying yes to change and to smart new ideas that put them first. So meet FairSquare, the real estate brokerage where sellers save thousands in commission, buyers get cash back, and experienced real estate professionals support you at every step. If you're open to change, you've got a choice. FairSquare, the new way home. Yours. Learn more at fairsquare.ca. FairSquare Group Realty. Restrictions apply.
Blog Talk Radio.
You are now listening to True Murder, the most shocking killers in true crime history, and the authors that have written about them. Gacy, Bundy, Dahmer, The Night Stalker, BTK. Every week, another fascinating author talking about the most shocking and infamous killers in true crime history. True Murder, with your host, journalist and author, Dan Zupansky.
Good evening. On December 21st, 1978, John Wayne Gacy was arrested. Upon an initial search of the crawl space beneath his ranch house in Norwood Park Township, Illinois, the authorities discovered the remains of several bodies. Eventually, the skeletal remains of 29 young men were unearthed on Gacy's property. Another four bodies were pulled from the river where Gacy dumped them off the Smith Bridge in Chanahan, Illinois, bringing the body count to 33 total. In 1978, Gacy held the title of America's most prolific serial killer. For the first time in print, John Wayne Gacy, Hunting a Predator, contains the police and other legal files covering the pursuit, arrest, and confession of Gacy. The book that we're featuring this evening is John Wayne Gacy, Hunting a Predator, The Pursuit, Arrest, and Confession, with my special guest, true crime filmmaker and author, John Borowski. Welcome to the program, and thank you very much for this interview, John Borowski.
Thank you for having me, Dan. It's a pleasure to be on.
Thank you very much. Thank you for joining us. Let's talk about the foreword to this book, how you came to be the author of this book, but talk about your connection with Dahmer and your interest in serial killers, how you came to that, as you explain in the foreword of this book.
Sure. So when I was growing up, I had known relatively little about serial killers. My background was always loving horror films. So started off with the Universal horror films and then worked my way through slashers. And then when I was in high school, I decided, well, I'm interested in horror films and makeup effects. So I started getting into special makeup effects. I reached out to Dick Smith, who had did the makeup effects for The Exorcist and The Godfather and many other classic films, you know, and then he had gotten me in touch with someone who was local near me in Chicago. And that's how I'd started doing makeup effects. And then I had shot short films on 8mm, which at the time, that's what it was before video. You know, you'd shoot, you'd send your film in to be developed, you'd get it back. And so I was actually, you know, using my makeup creations in these short films with my best friend. So I think it was when I was probably either a senior in high school or just after my senior year of high school, my best friend called me up and he said, you got to come over. So I went over to his house, and his father was a detective in Chicago when Dahmer was arrested. And I believe it was 91. So that would have just been when I graduated high school. So he had said, you got to come over here. And I went to his house, and what my friend thought was a mask catalog was actually the Dahmer file, which he found in his father's study. And it contained Dahmer's brief confession, but it also contained photocopies of photos that Dahmer took of his victims' heads on the sink, the amputated hands and body parts. And coming from a background of horror films, when I had seen these, this was real horror. It wasn't, you know, anything that was made up. So I was shocked at these photos. You know, the heads had the eyes open and the mouths were open and just awful, you know, and I couldn't get them out of my head. So when I went into college, I figured, well, for my first Film Tech 2 class, what better to do than a short film on the Dahmer case, including some of his confessions. So that was interesting. And also when I was in college, I had to do a paper on the history of Chicago, and I was looking through this one book, and they mentioned this castle of H.H. Holmes, that this guy had built this huge building in the 1800s and rented rooms during the World's Fair, and it was like a kind of murder mansion from the mind of Edgar Allan Poe. And of course, that fascinated me because I've always been into the macabre, but it wasn't really until I read Harold Checker's book, Deranged. Once I read Deranged, that really created H.H. Holmes as a more fascinating character, given the fact that he went to medical school and graduated medical school, and he had three wives and he had mistresses, and he was his own attorney at his trial. So I thought, wow, this isn't just some madman who, you know, designed this crazy building. This was an evil genius. And the next thing was, I looked up why there wasn't ever a film made on H.H. Holmes. So that was my first film out of college, H.H. Holmes, America's First Serial Killer. And that began my interest in serial killers. That was a big hit. So I just continued making films on serial killers. And, you know, I thought, well, who could top H.H. Holmes? And nobody had made a film about Albert Fish. So that was my second. And then I had done Pan's Ram, and then a film called Serial Killer Culture, which examines why people, authors, musicians, and artists and collectors are fascinated by serial killers. And I turned that into a TV show called Serial Killer Culture TV. And along the process, as I'm making my films, though, I figured, well, you know, I've got all these original documents and research materials. Why don't I just put my research materials into books? And that's how the books came about. So when you read my books, they may have a foreword by me or someone else, but they're really the original case documents, you know, and because there are so many books out on these serial killers, I thought, what could be more interesting than reading the words from the serial killers or the detectives, attorneys, and psychiatrists who chased and studied these serial killers?
You talk about the Just Gacy case, and you talk about the confession that's included in your book. You say that Gacy retracted this confession and denied everything eventually, but you have these source documents photocopied. And incredibly, just with the documents, just with the incredible photos that you've included, things like Gacy's birth certificate, amazing. All of these things tell the story of John Wayne Gacy, at the time the most prolific serial killer in American history. And your book includes information by the Des Plaines Police Department in Illinois, who tailed Gacy for 24 hours for 10 days in December 1978, which led to his apprehension, trial, and eventual execution. These documents are an excellent example of true detective work, basically some of the best detective work in history. This is all pre-DNA typing, as you write. What is this book dedicated to?
I dedicate the book to the Des Plaines Police Force. We had the kind of insight and kind of foreknowledge to, okay, let's create a task force, apprehend this guy. I mean, it's twofold. It's dedicated to the detectives who brought him down, as well as the victims, which were unfortunate, but it's really dedicated to the detectives who, without them, Gacy may have continued doing what he was doing. Obviously, his crawl space was filled, and then he started throwing bodies off the Smith Bridge and may have been caught eventually. But the tried and true detective work of the Des Plaines detectives, I interviewed two of the former detectives, Mike Albrecht and Dave Hackmeister, and some of their stories kind of move into the realm of absurdity. And this has all been interesting lately. I recently had revisited Goodfellas. It was re-released and shown at a theater out here actually right near Des Plaines, where Gacy was brought down, the Pickwick Theater. And watching that throughout almost the entire movie, you're laughing at the absurdity of this. Some of the aspects of the Gacy case are that absurd. I mean, these detectives brought down probably the top five most world-renowned serial killers ever, and they had to carry quarters in their pockets because their CBs wouldn't even reach their headquarters at the time period.
Yeah.
I mean, you talk about impossible odds, no cell phones, and they didn't even know what was going on. They had no idea that all these bodies were in the basement. They knew something was wrong because they knew one of their residents in Des Plaines was missing. He was last seen with this contractor, Gacy. So the Lieutenant Kozenczak, it was really because of him creating this task force of detectives. They created three different teams, one to, you know, look at Gacy's background, one to look at Rob Peace, the missing victim's background, and another one just to investigate Gacy now. And then when they investigated Gacy's background, they saw the sodomy charge in Waterloo, Iowa. They saw there were two or three arrests in Chicago since he had returned from Waterloo. Something's amiss here. And again, I dedicate it to them because they are the true heroes. And they're so, you know, even when I met the dentist who identified all of the, well, not all, but the majority of the remains, Dr. Pavlik, I said, "You're a hero." And just like the detectives, they all poo-poo it. And I'm like, man, you guys really, they're so, you know, down to earth and good people. But in the end, they are the true heroes of the story.
You provide in the documents, though, a very chilling story of what happened with Rob Peast. And then later, you provide the confession where Gacy freely talks about what happened with Rob Peast. But first, you also include very, very interesting, anybody that knows this story, but again, through the documents, you can tell this story as well. Tell us the story about the mother and Rob Peast and the pharmacy and the talk of the job and an interesting person that came forward, which was Kim Byers that worked in the photo section of that pharmacy. Tell us this horrible story, because we don't have the opportunity through the confession or through these documents to go through the 33 victims, the 20 or so that were identified and the nine that weren't. But let's go back to that date and how Gacy was tripped up finally, thankfully.
Yeah, they're all sad cases, obviously. But, you know, Rob Peace is probably the saddest. Just how it occurred and how everything went down. So Rob Peace was a teenager who was working at Nissen Pharmacy, and that was in Des Plaines. And he was trying to save money to buy a Jeep. That's what he wanted to do. He wanted to buy a Jeep. He was saving his money. So, you know, he's working at the pharmacy and always looking for extra work. So he's at the pharmacy one night, and there was this contractor who was, Gacy was there. Gacy was in the store. He was familiar with the owner, Phil Torf, and Kim Byers was there. She was another worker at the store. So they all had witnessed Gacy in there, you know, possibly talking to Rob Peace. And at one point in the night, Kim Byers, the other co-worker at the pharmacy, wanted to go outside. She had to run outside. I don't know if she smoked or wanted to grab something, but she asked to borrow Rob's jacket. So he said, no problem. He gave her this blue down jacket that he wore. And not knowing it, she had in her hands what she had given to the pharmacy was a, because again, in the old days, when you would develop photos, you would give them your roll of photographs and they would put it in an envelope and you'd get a little receipt. So when you come back to pick up your developed photos, you give them the receipt and pay and you get your photographs. So she had done that, and she had a little receipt from her photographs that she had put in Rob Peast's jacket. She totally forgot about it. So later she goes back in, she gives Rob Peast his jacket. She forgets about it. It's no big deal. So later in the night, about 9 o'clock, I think the store closed around 9 o'clock, just before nine, Rob Peace's mother had come to pick him up, and she went in the store. She had seen him. He said, okay, you know, I'll be out in a few. She went out front, was waiting for him, you know, and then 9 o'clock comes around, 9:10, 9:20. He's nowhere to be found. She goes back in. They say, well, we don't know where he went. You know, last we saw him, he said he was going to run outside and talk to that contractor guy. That's all he said. So that's where the story kind of began. So his mother went home and said, well, I'm sure he'll call her. Maybe he went home. No big deal. And it was her birthday. It was Rob Peace's mother's birthday. So they were going to celebrate her birthday. She was picking her son up. Goes home. Hour goes by. Hours go by. More hours go by, of course. You know, this good kid, you know, who never was in any trouble, never shows up the entire night. So the parents call the Des Plaines Police Department that night, and they take the information down. Early in the morning, Rob Peace's parents are there at the Des Plaines Police Department banging on the door. He never showed up. So that's when the investigation into the disappearance of Rob Peace began. And that's when they started asking people questions. They went to, obviously, during the investigation, they go to the pharmacy and they say, well, yeah, he talked to that contractor guy. Well, it may have been Gacy. He was in here. We're not sure if that was him because no one saw Rob Peace get into Gacy's vehicle. But the detectives are figuring out, okay, let's go and talk to this Gacy guy. So, you know, eventually, you know, they call Gacy and, you know, he said he would be in and makes excuses. And, you know, so eventually they do wind up talking to Gacy, and, you know, he kind of, you know, just because, you know, here's what happened. You know, my uncle was dying and, you know, I was at home and, you know, I don't know anything about this kid. I was there at that store earlier and that's all I know. And even after that, though, they thought there were, you know, inaccuracies in his story. So the Des Plaines Police Department did get a search warrant. And after that first search warrant, that was where all the red flags were raised, because when they searched Gacy's house, they found numerous IDs from different young men. They found pairs of handcuffs. They found dildos. They found books hidden about, you know, gay lovers and, you know, all this sodomy materials. They found a 2x4 that had holes drilled into it. So obviously, you know, their suspicions were raised. And then if a little, what actually happened is Rod Peace did go out to talk to John Wayne Gacy. When he went out, Gacy said, well, yeah, hop in the car. You know, I only live 5 minutes from here. We'll go to my house. We'll talk about it. You know, I could pay you more than what anybody else pays you. So it was really, you know, the allure of making more money that drew Rod Peace to John Wayne Gacy. And again, Gacy was well known. He was a nice guy. Everybody knew Gacy. So it wasn't like this was some stranger in a sense, because Phil Poor, the owner of the pharmacy, he knew Gacy. And Rod Peace did get in the car with Gacy. And he went to his house, which was, again, about 5 or 10 minutes away from the pharmacy. Gets there, Gacy's talking to him about, well, you know, I'm pretty liberal-minded myself. You know, what do you think about sex? What are your views on it? You know, have you ever heard of the Kinsey Report? You know, he does his usual spiel on Rod Peace, trying to feel him out to see if he's going to be easy or he's going to be hard victim. Well, it turned out that he wasn't really into it, and then Gacy started to show him the handcuff trick, and he said he was a registered clown and puts these handcuffs on Rod Peace, just like he did all his other victims, behind Rod Peace's back so he can't get out of them. He shows Rod Peace the key and says, well, here's the key. You know, this is how I got out of them. This is why you can't get out of them, because I have the key. And then he starts actually attempting to perform oral sex on Rod Peace, and Rod Peace wasn't able to achieve an erection, so Gacy started to do the rope trick. And two reasons for the rope trick. One, if you, it's kind of like when people do the autoerotic asphyxiation, that it's possible to have more of a blood flow, have an erection. So that was one reason. But eventually, once Gacy turned it even more, turned the rope around their neck, he would create a little knot, stick a stick in, and then create another knot and turn that like a tourniquet, eventually choking them within a matter of 30 seconds. So he was turning this on Rod Peace. Rod Peace was crying as Gacy was attempting oral sex on him. The phone rings. Gacy goes to answer the phone. When he comes back, Rod Peace is dead on the floor from the tourniquet on his neck. And then Gacy slept with the body overnight, may have had more sex with it. Gacy said he did. We're not sure of the exact details of that. And then Gacy took Rod Peace's body and put it in the attic. So the first time when the Des Plaines detective came to Gacy's house and searched the entire house, I'm sorry, prior to the first time of searching the house, when they just went to talk to Gacy, Rod Peace's body was still in the attic. So that's when Gacy, when they left, Gacy took the body down, took it to the river, threw it in the river, and then the Des Plaines police came back with a search warrant. So it, again, you know, it's just this chain of events that, and I think poor Rod Peace is probably, you know, they were all bad, but I think that one hit the closest to home because it was his last victim. And, you know, Gacy was just getting sloppy. You know, I think his lust overcame his mind at that point and probably even, you know, didn't even think about the fact that he was probably seen by other people and he would be fingered.
You talk about their suspicions once they have that search warrant, they see beyond red flags. So they put him under 24-hour surveillance pretty well, almost. You say almost 24-hour surveillance. So there's some gaps in that. Tell us, so how does he react to this 24-hour surveillance? Does he know it? When does he know it? And just tell us what the fruits of this surveillance are.
Yeah, you know, that surveillance by the Des Plaines Police Department was one of the first. There had never been a dedicated task force like that to apprehend a criminal. So Des Plaines gets a lot of kudos for actually forming this task force. And one of the units was the surveillance unit. So there was a unit to look at Gacy and his background, the unit to look at Rob Peast and his background and another unit to have surveillance of Gacy around the clock 24 hours. There was a day shift and a night shift. So the officers I interviewed, Hackmeister and Albrecht, they were the night shift. So they had started, I believe, at night, maybe midnight, and then they would go until noon the next day. So it was like, you know, 12, each one had a 12-hour shift. And at first, there wasn't a surveillance, but I think the first day or two after, I think especially after they had gone in with the first search warrant, that's where around, I believe it was 10 or 11 days total of the surveillance. And so they had started, it was a covert surveillance. That's what it was supposed to be at first. So Dave Hackmeister was the second shift on the scene. And when he arrived, he didn't see Gacy until the next morning. So Dave Hackmeister was parked on Gacy's block. And about 10 a.m. the next morning, Gacy came up his block, stopped, saw Dave Hackmeister and waved at him. So it was no longer a covert, you know, surveillance because Gacy knew. And along the whole time of the surveillance, Gacy was very nice to all the detectives. He knew what was going on. There were times when the first couple times when these detectives were following him, he would order them drinks. He would tell them to come over and sit with him when they were at a restaurant. He's like, why should we sit apart? I don't know why they're following me. You know, he would basically tell them that he was just this good guy that had a business and he doesn't know anything about this kid's disappearance. And then the surveillance team would interview other people and everyone all had great things to say about Gacy, his neighbors, his friends, his work acquaintances. This is just a jovial, you know, great guy from Chicago. This, you know, one of these great Polish guys that's an extrovert that is just a ton of fun. You're going to love him. So I could never see him doing anything bad. You know, so these detectives are following Gacy. But, you know, there are times where he would lose them. He would fly. You know, I got stories from the detectives that said they'd be doing these high speed chases in Chicago. Police would never stop them. They're chasing Gacy and he would lose them sometimes. So that's where the total 24-hour surveillance, you know, comes into play. Sometimes they had lost him, and he would just take off at high speeds.
There was also some evidence found, because there was a person named John, and I don't know the pronunciation, but Sizek. And in January 20th, 1977, he went missing. And tell us what they found, which they believe potentially was items belonging to John Sizek.
Yeah, the items belonging to John Sizek that, again, as they're doing this whole investigation, the first time when they went into Gacy's house, they had taken some photos of the rooms. And through their investigations, they had learned that John Sizek had a small television, a black and white television, that was very similar to the television that was in Gacy's house, as well as one of Gacy's employees had a car that was formerly owned by John Sizek. So they're trying to piece these pieces together and say, okay, this is kind of strange. So at one point, the day shift investigators said, well, you know what? If Gacy invites us into his house, we're going to go in. So one night, Gacy says, you want to go bowling? I'm going bowling. So the cops go bowling with him. They actually bowled some games, had some drinks with him. They go back to Gacy's house. He invites them in. They went in. And one of the guys said, well, you know what? Try and keep Gacy busy. I'm going to try and sneak into that room and write down the name of, you know, the serial number of that television to see if it was John Sizek's. So right. He asks Gacy, okay, you know, where's your restroom? Can I use it? Gacy tells him, yeah, it's down the hall over there. So the detective goes down the hall, goes to use the restroom. And as he's in the restroom, he smells a smell coming from the vents when the heater kicks in. And he said the last time he remembered smelling a smell like that was at the county morgue. Wow. So again, there are all these little clues leading up to to the eventual, you know, what we found out at the end of the investigation, but that's the serial number on that television, because right after he got out of the bathroom, he didn't want to be away too long. Gacy was coming. So, you know, they didn't find that out until the end. But again, along their investigation, they're putting all these pieces together, including when they go back to the pharmacy, one of the key pieces of evidence items was Kim Byers' film receipt. Because when the detectives actually did do the search of Gacy's house on the first search warrant, they looked in one of Gacy's garbage cans and they found that film receipt in Gacy's garbage can. So they went back to the pharmacy, interviewed Kim Byers, and Kim Byers said, that's my film receipt. I put it in Rob Peast's jacket pocket. So what that meant was that placed Rob Peast in Gacy's house because it was in his jacket when Kim Byers had given him his jacket back. So they knew at some point Gacy had been in touch with Rob Peast or he had been in that house.
Yeah. Gacy changed his demeanor and became more frantic and erratic in his behavior, you know, under this surveillance, under this 10 days. But part of that was that when they were under surveillance, and even when they were first at Gacy's home, there was employees of his construction company that would come to the home. And of course, eventually these people were questioned. From the information that they gave police, and Gacy really didn't know what they really could say or what they did say, just thought they might be loyal. What kind of information did they learn from like guys like Mike Rossi and David Cham, I believe his last name is?
Cram. Yeah. You know, Gacy had many young men that he had employed for his business, PDM Construction. Of course, some of those employees he actually murdered, and they found their bodies later. But he had several devoted employees, and two of them were Michael Rossi and David Cram. And these young men would, as far as Gacy said, he would have them dig trenches in his crawl space. So what Gacy would tell these kids is, look, I need you to dig trenches in the crawl space because it gets flooded down there with all this storm water. And, you know, I have a sump pump down there, but you need to build these trenches. So supposedly, according to Gacy, that he would supervise them when they would go down there and dig some of these trenches, that he would say, oh, no, you got to stay over there. Make sure you're there. Don't go further this way. Don't go further that way. And eventually, David Cram and Michael Rossi were interrogated by the Des Plaines police. And they talked to them about Gacy and his businesses. And then the detectives asked them about the crawl space. And they told them, yeah, well, he had us go down there and dig some trenches. But especially Michael Rossi, when they talked to him about it, they said, look, we're trying to find this Rob Peast, this kid that disappeared. We're going to ask you this specifically. Would there be anywhere on the property that you would think this kid would be? And Michael Rossi told them specifically the crawl space. Now, why he said that, who knows? You know, there are many conspiracies that people were involved with the actual murders with Gacy, but that's a whole nother thing to get into. But supposedly these two were digging trenches for him.
Right. Also, some of the evidence that was found was highly incriminating, too. You talk about some of the pills, amyl nitrate. Tell us some of the things that were found that are also very, very incriminating when you look at this case, or anyone would look at it.
Yeah, Gacy, you know, in the end, it turned into an addict. You know, he was addicted to alcohol and Valium and uppers and downers. And, you know, he would get these from his contacts at these pharmacies, you know, where he had done jobs. So he didn't have prescriptions. He would get these things for free or he'd offer them to his victims and knock them out. But towards the end there, it was really bad, especially when the police were chasing Gacy down. There were times where he was probably so hopped up on pills that when they were chasing him towards the end, the last day, actually, when he was apprehended, you know, Mike Albrecht said his head was bobbing and he's holding his rosary and they didn't know if he was going to kill himself or run himself off the road or kill someone else. And that's when they decided to take him down because, you know, they saw what was going on and they knew that he had given some cannabis to a young man that worked at a gas station earlier in the day. And they said, well, we're just going to take him down for this. They couldn't even really communicate with their headquarters. When they finally did, the headquarters told them, do what you have to do. The detective said, okay. And it was, again, the heroes made the choice. They said, we're just going to take him down and we're just going to use the cannabis, you know, arrest. So, and, you know, authorities had found a bottle that had smelled from chloroform because one of Gacy's living victims, there were some living victims, and one of Gacy's living victims, Jeff Rignall, said that's what Gacy used to knock him out. It was this rag soaked in the substance.
Meet Fair Square, the real estate brokerage where sellers save thousands in commission and buyers get cash back with professional support at every step. It's the new way home. Yours, fairsquare.ca. Fair Square Group Realty. Restrictions apply.
So you talked about that amyl nitrate or the whatever chemical he used to be able to incapacitate him being found as well.
In this, yes, the chloroform.
The chloroform, yeah, pardon me, yes. Tell us about the investigation from there, though. I mean, once we have him in custody, he is panicked. And through that 10-day surveillance, he becomes panicked and erratic. And now he's at a different state. The surveillance also recorded that he had been to his lawyer, Sam Amaranti. Wasn't it the evening before? So then when he comes into the station, what are the kind of things, amazingly, that you have in these documents that he starts asking the authorities?
Yeah,
like referencing about whether they'd been in the crawl space.
Yes. The night before, Gacy had been to his attorney's office, Sam Aramonte, where he confessed everything to Sam Aramonte. Sam Aramonte, of course, could not tell the detectives because of the lawyer-client, you know, privilege. And he said, well, you can't let Gacy go. Shoot his tires out if you have to. And the cop said, no, we can't do this. We can't shoot out his tires. You got to let us know. And he couldn't. So anyway, that's when it started the beginning of the end, that entire day where Gacy was erratic. And everywhere they would follow Gacy went to one of his best friend's house, where later they learned that Gacy asked one of his friends for a gun, because what he wanted to do is go outside, shoot one of the cops, and then they would shoot him, suicide by cop. That's how some of these criminals, you know, choose to die, you know, rather than kill themselves. They want to be taken out. But of course, his friend didn't give him the gun. So eventually, when they do arrest Gacy for the cannabis possession, they took him to the hospital because, as always, Gacy in the past would claim he was having these fake heart attacks. So they took him to a hospital in Des Plaines, you know, and they tell the doctors, test him for everything because we want to keep him here for as long as possible. Because while they're there, the Des Plaines police are trying to get this final search warrant. Well, not final, the second search warrant. There were numerous other ones to come after that. But the second search warrant to actually go into his house and go into the crawl space. So eventually they do, and that's when they found bones of two human remains in the crawl space while Gacy's at the hospital. So they take him back to the police station in Des Plaines, and they start this first confession. Again, there are going to be three confessions from Gacy. The first one was the one with just the Des Plaines police detectives present. And Gacy is asking them, well, did you go in the crawl space? Who else do you have here? He was trying to feel the cops out to find out what they knew. Did they have Mike Rossi and David Cram? What did they tell them? You know, did they find bodies? Gacy was not a genius. He was a natural predator. He wasn't at the level of, say, a genius-wise as maybe an A.T.H. Holmes, but he was definitely a natural predator. So his actions didn't necessarily correspond with his intelligence. You know, he didn't even finish high school. But again, he was a cunning predator, and that's what got him through all these things. So he knew he wasn't going to go in there and confess all these things. Even when you read his confession, he doesn't confess everything, says some things, some bodies. Yeah, here's what I did. I buried them down there. I showed them the handcuff trick and then the rope trick, and then they were dead and they deserved to die. These kids just wanted money from me. They said they would tell others that I was gay and they would expose me, and that's why I killed them. And he would go back and forth with his reasonings. It's very difficult when you read the confession. It's not like, okay, it's not like a Dahmer. Here's what I did from day one to this victim, to all these victims, and here are their names, here are the details. He wasn't like that. And then after that, there were two other confessions that followed, one in the presence of his attorney. Because as Gacy's going on, then he's trying to develop an insanity defense, trying to say, well, it wasn't me, it was the bad John, or it was Jack. That's one of my other personalities. Jack did these things. So there's that. Even at one point during the interrogation with his attorney there, where the detective, Mike Albrecht, is saying, Jack, well, hey, Jack, we're asking you a question, Jack. And John Gacy doesn't respond. And then after that, the detective said, oh, hey, John, your attorney, you know, we want to ask you a question. Oh, what? So that blew it right out of the water right there. It was kind of too early for Gacy to have the multiple personality aspect, the lies of that down pat, because Gacy was, it's hard for people to imagine, but Gacy was 100% normal physically. And all the tests that were done on him, you know, as far as his brain and his body were concerned, came back fine.
What was interesting too is his views on homosexuality. What were those?
Yeah, it's a belief by many people that Gacy hated himself for being homosexual. And when you do look back, the further you go back, especially when you're talking about the 1950s in America, that was probably the worst time in American history, if there ever was, you know, or if it actually ended, you know, I believe it still continues in a sense, but it wasn't as bad as it was in the 50s. That was the time period where basically you could be arrested for being gay. So here's Gacy growing up as a child and having these feelings, attractions towards other men in the 50s and 60s. And it's being told, you know, by friends, family, churches, everyone that it's abhorrent and, you know, you're a freak. And obviously not to him directly because he hid it. But these are the signs and signals that he was getting from society. So he hid it just like he did throughout his entire life. So eventually, when he was arrested, he said that basically, you know, these young kids were scum. They were, you know, gay prostitutes, just hustlers who wanted to get money out of him. And, you know, like other people, you know, he just saw gays as being disgusting, even though he was one himself. So in the end, it's my belief that Gacy was created by his father's hatred of gays, his father's physical and mental abuse on Gacy, but also society. You know, society created this internalized hatred within John Gacy when society tells us that being gay is bad. And look at how it came about. Is it any wonder that he buried his sex with his victims? He buried them just like he buried his being gay?
Yes. Let's use this as an opportunity to stop for a second to talk about our sponsor, which is Caliper. The great thing about CBD is that you don't have to make radical changes to your daily routine just to feel the benefits of CBD. Now, a far better way to consume CBD, Caliper. Unlike CBD oils, Caliper CBD powder is completely tasteless and it mixes easily in any food or drink with no oily taste. Exactly 20 milligrams in each packet of Caliper CBD. I start my day with Caliper CBD added to my protein drink. I've noticed since starting I feel less sore, I have a bad neck, and I feel a little calmer in general also. Choose a CBD product that's clinically proven to be superior to standard CBD oils. Proven that you can absorb 450% more CBD with Caliper CBD powder compared to tinctures. That is impressive. And Caliper gives those benefits in just 15 minutes, about twice as fast as CBD oil. Caliper CBD comes in 10 and 30 count packs. You can get started for under $20. All natural, non-GMO ingredients, no fillers, added chemicals, or artificial flavors. Get 20% off your first order when you use promo code MURDER at TryCaliper.com/murder. You can try Caliper CBD risk-free for 30 days. If you don't love it, they'll give you a full refund. That's TryCaliper.com/murder. Don't forget promo code MURDER for 20% off your first order. Now, incredibly, in this book, John Wayne Gacy, Hunting a Predator, you include more details from this confession, things that I had not read previously in any book about John Wayne Gacy. And that being the idea that he called some of his murders doubles. And in this, you include a document where it's graphic descriptions in the confession of what he does when he finds two young men and takes them home. And he said they wanted to have a good time. Tell our audience a little bit about bringing two men home and the tricks that he does and the horror that these two men encounter with Gacy.
So Gacy would pick up victims either alone or with another person or two. Again, there are, you know, are unknowns. There are many unknowns in this case, and there may never be answers to them. But anyway, Gacy would pick up these young teenagers and say, hey, do you want to have a good time? I got some weed. Look, I got some smoke here and we can just go back to my place and play pool and relax. And, you know, again, you're talking about, you know, the 70s, and it was natural for kids to get in the cars with strangers, which is, it still kind of shocks me because in the 50s and 60s, you had this whole stranger danger thing, you know, which was actually created because of a serial killer named Albert Fish, because he would kidnap and murder little children. So in the 70s, though, anything went. You know, they'd hitchhike, kids would hitchhike, they'd, you know, there were no cell phones, be back before dark, they would be told by their parents or whatever it is, you know. So this was natural at that time period, swinging, all these sex parties. So it's hard to put ourselves back in that time period, but that's the atmosphere. So anyway, sometimes Gacy would bring two victims back to his place. And in this one instance, Gacy talks about it, and he would call them doubles. And these serial killers, many would do doubles. Ted Bundy would do doubles sometimes. But what was unique about Gacy, he actually did two at the same time, just in one night. So he brought these two young men back and started drinking and having some fun times with them. And he took one of the young men into his bedroom, murdered him in the bedroom, came out, and then did the handcuff trick on the other kid that was there and said, all right, come in the bedroom. Here, I'm going to show your friend. I just killed him. And then he would kill the other kid. So, and sometimes he would even murder one of these kids right in front of the other one because he would have them both incapacitated with handcuffs. It's just an awful situation. And they knew he was telling the truth, Gacy, because when they would go and excavate the crawl space, as well in my book, there's the excavation documents of all the bodies they found in the crawl space and on his property, they would find two bodies, one on top of another. So it was true.
What are some of the things in the excavation that they found? Again, just chilling corroboration of things like the strangulation. What are some of the things they found, like in mouth concerning the rope? Tell us some of the things that they did find.
There was one body. There's a slide that was given to me by someone on the prosecution team and actually allowed, you know, me to use this in the film. And it's a shot of one of the bodies face with all the dirt removed from around the body, and around the skull, still on around the neck, is the rope, the ligature that Gacy used to choke them to death. And you could still see the loops in the rope. That's the evidence right there. So when it came to trial, as much as Gacy wanted to prove that he was insane, there was so much evidence that was actually still contained on the bodies. And also many of the bodies had underwear or rags stuffed down their throats. And when they excavated the bodies, that underwear or the rags were still in that area around their throats. If whether it was skeletonized or if there was still tissue remaining, they still found these rags and underwear in their throats. Now, there are several different theories behind that. One of them, of which Gacy said, one of his victims early on, Gacy had stored inside his closet and left the body upside down, and blood leaked out of the mouth or part of the body onto the rug.
Right.
So Gacy learned from that, and supposedly he started stuffing rags or underwear in the mouths of his victims so they wouldn't leak anymore. Now, another theory is that he learned that at this morgue when he worked at a morgue in Las Vegas when he was younger. But the other theory, which kind of also makes a lot more sense to me, is that he was living in this quiet suburban neighborhood. He was living in Norwood Park Township, which was near Park Ridge, where his attorney's office was. And when I filmed at these locations at night, you could hear a pin drop, even though they're near O'Hare Airport. If a plane isn't flying overhead, there's no one out in the street. It's quiet as a mouse out there. So I believe that Gacy also stuffed these, you know, rags down their throats to keep neighbors from hearing them screaming while he was torturing them.
Incredible. Something I read, and there's so much I learned from this book, talk about Gacy complained to a friend that they had taken his books, and he said, oh, there were Playboy, there were smut magazines, there were books. But he also says in the confession that he used the books, some of the books, for psychological torture for his victims. Can you tell us any more about those books at all?
Yeah, you know, there were many books that, you know, Gacy had, and these were found when investigators went in, but these books were hidden, you know, whether they were in his attic, or his second wife even found some of these gay magazines that he had laying around. Gacy would read some of these books where young gay men were tortured or abused, and he would actually take a lot of that information that he learned and used it on his victims. Now, what's interesting is there were living victims. So that's the strange conundrum, that Gacy actually let some of his victims go. And the belief behind that is that he may have let some of the victims go who may not have posed a threat. So in other words, if there were victims that said, you know, I'm going to go to the cops and I'm going to tell everyone that I know that you're gay and that you raped me, these were the ones that he would most likely murder. Who knows? You know, again, there are some answers. We may never know the actual truth behind, you know, Gacy's actions.
He also said that some people came by, gave him a tough luck story, and he felt sorry for them and even gave him some money. So they luckily weren't desirable to him, at least that evening.
And, you know, that's kind of the strange duality about serial killers. Not only can they hold a normal, supposed normal life and do these murders, but strangely enough, they may be compassionate at times. Now, you know, there was this theory about serial killers that they were either fire starters or they wet their beds or they're cruel to animals. Well, Gacy had animals when he was younger. He had a dog when he was arrested. He was never cruel to animals. Interestingly enough, you know, when you look at Dennis Rader, the BTK killer, before he murdered one of his victims, he put a pillow under their head to make them comfortable. Now, you know, how do you, me, it's impossible to look at, you know, the serial killer doing their actions. But at the same time, you know, they either have children themselves. Look at Albert Fish. He never swore to his grandchildren or his children or never, you know, laid a hand on them to, you know, punish them. But you're talking about a man who would kidnap little children, murder them, and cannibalize them. And this is that weird conundrum with serial killers that, yes, they are maybe capable of compassion, but they're also capable of, you know, some of the most despicable actions ever committed by human beings.
Yeah, certainly. Interestingly, too, this search through the crawl space, and which took days and numerous bodies were coming up, but it was a laborious effort to be able to unearth this. And eventually, that's, like you say, chisel and hammer to be able to break up cement and get to the final bodies. Gacy really wasn't much help. Like you say, it wasn't like some serial killers in knowing all of the details and keeping detailed records. So they had to identify them through the methods that they had, like clothing that matched, you know, the identification from those reported missing. How many victims were identified and how many unidentified, obviously?
Yeah, they went down in the crawl space with spoons. I mean, they were doing a meticulous job down there. And, you know, they had found other bodies on his property. There was one in the under the garage. There was one under the driveway. You know, so even months later, after the excavation of his crawl space, they were still finding bodies. You know, initially, there were 9 unknown victims. So how they identified the victims were either through dental records. And if they didn't have those, what they did was they took all of the evidence that was either in Gacy's house or with the victims, jewelry, clothing, and they had, you know, they put out a press release to the newspapers that said, if anyone has a missing relative or loved one, you could come and look at these items to see. Some even came and said, yeah, those belong to my son. And they found their son alive later. Again, one of the living victims. So in the initial case, there were 9 victims that were not identified, but the case was reopened several years ago. So now the case is open and ongoing, and the Cook County Sheriff's Department is in charge. Lieutenant Jason Moran is doing a phenomenal job, and he has identified 3 of the 9, which were unidentified. So there are 6 more still to be identified. He even found victims that were alive. And he found victims that were deceased unrelated to the Gacy case. So, you know, again, people say, why are you releasing books and documentaries on John Wayne Gacy 40 years after the case? Well, this is a perfect example. If there's anything that could be gleaned or learned about either Gacy, his psychology, or finding some of these victims that weren't identified, all of that is important.
Yes, certainly. This trial started in February 6, 1980, Rockford, Illinois, the Rob Peast murder case. 79 prosecution witnesses, as you write, 22 defense witnesses, and trial ended March 12, 1980, with a 2-hour deliberation by the jury. He had pled not guilty. How serious a defense was this? And you don't really have this in the documents, but was his defense this split personality? Obviously, the jury didn't buy it, but what was it?
Yeah, that was the defense, the split personality. That's what they were trying to stick to. They brought in, you know, an army of experts to testify to that, that he wasn't of sound mind. It was several aspects. The split personality, that he wasn't of sound mind, that because of the split personality, and they kind of blamed a little on the drugs and alcohol, that he wasn't really of sound mind. That was the defense, you know, but the prosecution, they had all of the evidence from all of their witnesses that showed he was of a sound mind. When he picked Rob Peast up at the pharmacy, you know, all the witnesses that were there, the evidence, like I said, the body with the rope still around its neck, you know, there was no way. And even after Gacy was found guilty, for 14 years, he was trying to appeal that. It's just, as we discussed, you know, in a sense, I wished he could have been like a Dahmer and told the truth, because in a sense, Gacy could have made himself to be out the most evil human being, serial killer that ever lived. But for whatever reason, probably trying to get appeals, he took back his confessions and never admitted to it, you know, until his, you know, even to his dying day.
He had an interesting life behind bars, and people know a little bit about it, at least in terms of they've heard that he's an artist of some degree, I guess. Tell us a little bit about this, some of the documents that you provide, the letters that you provide that demonstrate this life after conviction behind bars.
To me, Gacy was the first true serial killer celebrity. And you talk about it now, and you know, many of these other serial killers and criminals have reached that level of stardom. But if you think about it, before John Wayne Gacy, people were fascinated by true crime, but no one had reached the level of celebrity that John Wayne Gacy did. In addition to painting and selling paintings and having a business out of his prison cell in Menard Prison, Gacy also had a 900 number where people could call into the 900 number and listen to Gacy talking about the reasons why he was not guilty, disputing all the evidence in the case. And he also had people that would write him and visit him. And then when you would visit him, the guards were outside his cell, would take a Polaroid picture of you with Gacy, and they would charge you $1 for the photo. Everyone. Jeez. Once Gacy was in prison, everyone was making money off Gacy. The entire prosecution and defense team, it was all about money. Now Sam Amaranti has a new documentary based on his book. Everyone involved in the case wrote a book. So it was interesting that after Gacy was apprehended, everyone was earning money off of John Wayne Gacy. And years later, they poo-poo murder Bealey and the people that collect this stuff. But when you go further back, when you think about it, it was really all the attorneys that were, you know, and law enforcement personnel that were the originators of, you know, writing books and true crime kind of, you know, research.
Mm-hmm. There is an incredible amount of, I guess, source documents, and there's photocopies of that, but also things that, like the birth certificate. Tell us some of the incredible, unique things that are contained in this book, just for the person that thinks they've seen everything about Gacy and just wants to know more. What is included in this book, incredibly?
Yeah, what's included in this book is the entire surveillance documents. What is also included are the interviews with David Cram and Michael Rossi, the evidence lists of all the evidence and vehicles which were in Gacy's house in his possession, the evidence technician reports on the excavation. So the evidence technicians made meticulous notes on each body and how it was discovered and the state of the body. The official statement of the facts, which was used in the opening of the court case by the prosecution. Letters to Gacy, which people would write to him in prison, show what, you know, how much of a serial killer celebrity he was. And another birth and death certificates, but also Gacy's completed bio review. So when people would write Gacy in prison, this is pretty interesting too, and I heard Dennis Rader does this as well. So when people would write Gacy in prison, the first thing Gacy would do is he would send you this blank questionnaire, which would include questions like, what's your favorite color? What's your favorite sports team? But they also included, what's your favorite sex position? All of these other, you know, little sexual innuendo questions. But Gacy filled one out himself, you know, and so when you read my book, it's in there. And surprisingly, one of his favorite songs is Send in the Clowns.
Jeez. Also, he talks about his favorite TV shows, which is Unsolved Mysteries, and movies, Goodfellas and Ten Commandments. His hobbies are oil painting and study of human interest, and his regrets are being so trusting and gullible. So, and, yeah, oh, yeah, and his fears were dying before clearing his name with the truth. So very interesting.
Well, yeah, exactly. You know, he, you know, till his dying day, Gacy always made himself out to be the victim, you know, and he even wrote a book in prison, you know, which he made himself out to be the so-called 34th victim, where he was innocent and he didn't do any of these things. So
there have been rumors, and you include this as well, about this infamous Ripper crew from Chicago area. Tell us about that investigation, per se, into if the Ripper crew had any connection to John Wayne Gacy whatsoever.
Yeah, the Ripper crew was a team of, I believe, three or four members were abducting, torturing, and murdering women throughout the Chicagoland area. And this was just after Gacy was apprehended. So one of the members of the Ripper crew, I think it was Cork Allen, he had said something like, well, yeah, at least we weren't like Gacy, you know, we didn't keep all our victims under our house. That, just that one statement led to this urban legend, this myth that one of the members of the Ripper crew, his name was Robin Gett. The myth is that he had at one time worked for Gacy in the past and may have helped him with the murders. Well, it's false. It never happened. So right. In my researches, one of my friends, Bruce LeMaster, who runs a site called Killer's Crawl Space, he had a letter from Robin Gett. And basically, Robin Gett states in this letter that he was unequivocally never employed by Gacy, and he never knew Gacy, nor worked for him, nor met Gacy. So that puts an end to it. But, you know, people like these urban legends and myths, and they'll still say that it happened, you know, and I'm still working on getting Robin Gett to, you know, talk to me on audio for my film version, because I'm obviously, you know, doing a film and miniseries too, and I'm referencing my own book. So as I'm working on my film and miniseries, I'm continually looking into my own book for all the evidence and research information.
Tell us a little bit more about this movie adaptation, film adaptation.
Initially, I went into the Gacy case wanting to create a film based on Gacy's life, because primarily I do documentary films, and it usually puts the serial killer's life under a microscope from their birth to their execution, their entire life. Well, as I was producing the Gacy documentary, there was so much material. And of course, since I'm in Chicago and from Chicago, it's a little bit easier for me to access people and locations. And so I have a wealth of material. And what was initially going to be a film has turned into a mini series, because I have at least enough material for a minimum of 4 to 6 hours to complete a mini series. But right when the COVID-19 hit, I was nearing the end of production. So there are still people and locations which I have to interview for the mini series. But I do have enough to release at least like a film as a little teaser of the mini series. So I figured, well, while I have material, I might as well be productive. And hopefully, you know, by this August, the intention is to release a 90-minute film which concentrates on the house, the murders, the excavation. But at the beginning and the end of the film, there will be 2 to 3 minutes as a prologue and an epilogue, which kind of shows what came before and after, which kind of gives hints to the scope of the miniseries and how much information there is before and after the house was discovered there.
Yeah, incredible. And this case really does warrant as much coverage as possible. It's such a fascinating case. It's one of the most interesting cases to me. When I did read Terry Sullivan's book years and years ago, I just couldn't believe the magnitude of John Wayne Gacy and his crimes. And so, like you say, very much like yourself, I was a big horror fan. But when I would read things like that, I realized that this was certainly true horror. And it certainly had everything on, you know, nonfiction, much stranger than fiction by a long shot. So
that's what I'd like to focus on for the film version, the horror, the house, the bodies, you know, all of that. But then, like I said, imagine watching that, but then being able to later, maybe next year, watch a 4 to 6 hour miniseries that tells, oh, here's his past. Here are the reasons why he may have did these things growing up gay with so much negativity. And then what comes after being a celebrity. And I've got great interviews. Walter Jacobson, who was one of the only people to interview Gacy at Menard. Yeah, I have him on camera. Karen Conti, Gacy's last attorney. Bill Kunkel, the prosecutor in the case. The two detectives, the surveillance detectives, you know, so many people. And, you know, it's going to be great. And I'm glad that there is so much interest, because when I do my conventions or lectures, you know, sometimes people come up to me and say, oh, we're worried about our daughter, our son, because they're fascinated by the stuff. And I tell them, no, nourish that, because there are future law enforcement officers, judges, forensic psychologists. We're doing this so we could try and figure out what makes these people tick. I don't focus on the sensationalism and the gore. It's all about their psychology and the methods that the detectives use to apprehend and convict these criminals.
Yes, it's extraordinary. The minds of serial killers, but also the minds and motivations of these dedicated law enforcement professionals to persist until they get an arrest like this. And then truly, this was a task force extraordinaire and an historic investigation, true crime investigation, wasn't it?
Oh, yeah. It was very historic. You know, first time, very historic. And, you know, even now, when you think about what the Sheriff's Department is doing, and they're successfully doing it, looking back at a case 40 years ago and still trying to identify these six unknown victims, I mean, that to me is almost impossible, but they're doing it.
Yes, very honorable, honorable pursuit. I want to thank you very much, John Borowski, for talking about John Wayne Gacy, Hunting a Predator, The Pursuit, Arrest, and Confession. It's been fascinating. For those that might want to take a look at the other work that we mentioned, do you have a website, a Facebook page? Tell us a little bit more about that.
Sure. If you'd like to check out my films, all of my films are streaming on Amazon Prime. So films like H.H. Holmes, Albert Fish, Carl Panzeram, Serial Killer Culture, my show Serial Killer Culture TV, those are on Amazon Prime. And the best place to purchase products would be my store, which is store.johnborowski.com, or my site, which is just my name, johnborowski.com.
Well, that's great. Thank you very much, John Borowski, for John Wayne Gacy, Hunting a Predator. It's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you very much. You have a great evening.
Thank you, Dan, for having me on. Bye-bye.
Good night.
Every day, more people are saying yes to change and to smart new ideas that put them first. So meet Fair Square, the real estate brokerage where sellers save thousands in commission, buyers get cash back, and experienced real estate professionals support you at every step. If you're open to change, you've got a choice. Fair Square, the new way home. Yours. Learn more at fairsquare.ca. Fair Square Group Realty. Restrictions apply.
A Canadian journalist infiltrates an international network of violent extremists.
They don't care who they maim or hurt or kill.
White supremacists who want to spark a race war and incite the collapse of society.
Embrace the chaos, and from its ashes, a new world shall rise to victory, white man!
I'm Michelle Shepherd, and I'll take you inside this movement to learn where it came from and where it's headed next. White Hot Hate, available now on CBC Listen and everywhere you get your podcasts.
Meet Fair Square, the real estate brokerage where sellers save thousands in commission and buyers get cash back with professional support at every step. It's the new way home. Yours. Fairsquare.ca. Fair Square Group Realty. Restrictions apply.